Good evening. This is Mae Brussel on KAZU FM in Pacific Grove, California. It's October 15th, 1984. It's program number 671. I took 10 weeks off the air, but continued to make the tapes, as you know, those subscribers who were getting them, and decided that I would go back on the air. There were a series of harassments that I haven't detailed, instances that have happened in the past weeks, and I decided that either they're all coincidental or they're going to continue, and I may as well just do what I like to do, which is to share the broadcast with you instead of just sending them out to people who can afford to subscribe. There's many listeners who can't, and the information is important, and when you retreat from this kind of a thing, I think you're in worse shape than if you just go on doing what you like to do. Ronald Reagan will be reelected. I think he'll be out because of various scandals that'll mount on his back. And I'd like to share with the information on those various aspects of his personnel and our government, which we share together every week. I always begin with what we were talking about last year at this time. But 2 years ago this week, October the 18th, 1982, was the time when Attorney General William French Smith announced at a press conference that he was nominating, or the president was nominating, Helene von Damm as the ambassador to Vienna. She's there in that position now. She helped Reagan and Edwin Meese with the transition team. She married a gentleman from New Jersey, and because the bulk of this program and the next 3 weeks will be on Raymond Donovan and New Jersey, I bring that out because we never have seen pictures or read much about Byron Leeds. She keeps the name of her third husband, Christian von Damm, a German who is working for Bank of America in La Paz, Bolivia. I think those connections could easily lead to Klaus Barbie and the CIA connections because of so many of the Nazis and Licio Gelli and that gang around Ronald Reagan's administration, and also with Michael Sindona, with Richard Nixon's administration. But she was nominated, or they announced that she would be the new ambassador, and she went on, and she is there at the present time. Also, last year, Ronald Reagan had a quotation in the London Observer that I mentioned, October the 25th. He said it was regarding the Korean airline and the Larry McDonald demise, deep-sixing into the ocean, and Reagan said, in quotes, the administration thought the impact would blow over in 2 or 3 weeks. Well, it didn't blow over, and I bring that up again because there's a quotation I'll share with you soon where he said the Raymond Donovan hearing investigation will be over in a few weeks. And, of course, Edwin Meese was cleared by a Watergate-connected, supposed to be an inspector, attorney investigating Edwin Meese, and, of course, he got cleared. Now, Ronald Reagan got surprised because after Larry Flynt had his full-page ad on the Korean airline, there followed, not because of it, but followed a natural sequence, all kinds of articles escalating with the allegations in Great Britain and America and around the world that the United States had foreknowledge and that this was a plane that was dropped into the ocean that could have been prevented. And no one person is yet clear, as clear as I was on the motives when I wrote the article for Larry Flynt in The Hustler in February 84. But this week in People's World is an article given to me by a listener to these broadcasts, quoting Andreas Papandreou from Greece, saying that Ronald Reagan and the CIA were behind the Korean airline. And the important thing is that this is the first head of state of a government that is selecting the President of the United States as being responsible for 269 deaths and all the political implications that go with it. Now, David Emery up north, who I mentioned his name many times, sent me an article about that was in the San Jose Mercury about the gentleman who went into a television station and shot the sales manager because he claimed that he was being programmed through the cable TV. This was in the San Jose Mercury, June the 6th, 1984. In Winston-Salem, North Carolina, a man thought that the 700 Club, the syndicated religious program, was spying on him through the cable television. This is how the spying was done, through the television company hookup. And he went into WJTM and shot the manager, William N. Rissmeller, who had only been there a short time, a few weeks. He was living in Greenboro. temporarily, and he went in and shot him and took a woman at the station as a hostage. And he said the 700 Club that's broadcast on this station and another station were spying on him and used the cable TV for that purpose, and he wouldn't stop holding his hostage until they apologized on the cable and said, yes, we were. That doesn't mean they were. But he had the feeling that some messages were coming through him, and he went to the television and killed the gentleman there. Similar to Lawrence Kwong, who was a mind control object, a zombie who went to shoot in San Francisco at KGO, and Jim Dunbar was on the air. He couldn't shoot through the bulletproof glass, but he shot the station manager and then went down the street and killed himself. I mention this because of the sounds coming through my TV. And after I mentioned that on Monday, the Tuesday, the TV cable service was here, because I'm having trouble with the cable on some of the televisions. It's blurry, not the sound coming through. And I asked him, can you get somebody talking to you through your television? And he said, yes, it's hard to catch the culprits, but you can. It can be done. The trick is to try and catch them. I didn't tell him why I wanted to catch them, but that's what he said, it could be done. And I know that at the time of the Watergate, as I said before, there were plans for the CIA and for the Office of Emergency Service to have a two-way where they would speak to you through your television. But the problem was that they could also hear what is said in your house. It'd be a two-way affair. Now, I was talking about the religious fundamentalists and Falwell and the links to the military on the last three broadcasts, and I mentioned the organization in Washington, the Coalition for Peace Through Strength. Jerry Falwell is co-chairman with various members of the Pentagon and Admiral Moore, who works close with Henry Kissinger and is on Western Goals, and Phyllis Schlafly, the far right, who also is behind and supporting Mr. Pat Robertson, and William Simon, who's on the board of Helionetics, the company that would make a good hunk of the contracts for the Star Wars with Edward Teller. Edward Teller, incidentally, and the company of Helionetics were indicted in the court in L.A. I'll do more on this next week, but they were just given an indictment for hanky-panky financial affairs, and I'll detail that for you. But John Singlaub of the World Anti-Communist League, their links to the Los Angeles Police Department, the Western Goals, and the military, these various people that Jerry Falwell works with and is co-chairman of, I put on the sheet going with those broadcasts. Their Washington office is 499 South Capitol Street, Washington, D.C., 20003. And a long subscriber to these broadcasts in Canada called me last night and said, May, get out your sheet for broadcast 617, October the 3rd, 1983, a year ago. And I was talking about Lieutenant General Daniel Graham, the former head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, who worked with John Reese from Western Goals. Again, Edward Teller and John Singlaub and Helen Marie Taylor. All these people jump from the spying of the police department to the making of the space stations and the space wars. Well, I had listed General Graham's address, given to be by another researcher in the East, has an office on strategic trade with Dr. Fritz Kramer, the man behind Henry Kissinger and Alexander Haig in particular. And the offices for these men is 499 South Capitol Street, Washington, D.C., Suite 404A. This is sort of like Lee Harvey Oswald being in New Orleans and having his office on Camp Street and backing up to the FBI offices and sharing the offices with the FBI, where he's supposed to be such a renegade Marxist. So that was very good finding the address. It just missed me completely. It may be a 100-story skyscraper. It may be a 10-story building. It may be a huge building compound. I don't know who else is in this building, but it's interesting that Daniel Graham, who helped Ronald Reagan set up his entire Star War approach to defense system, that trillion-dollar system, and who also works through these various intermediaries and contacts with general, other generals, and Admiral Moore and General Singlaub, also has the Falwell offices of this strategic coalition of peace through strength. I love it. It sounds like 1984, a coalition for peace through strength. And, of course, Graham and Kramer's office is the Institute of Strategic Trade. So they are in the same building. Not this evening, but as soon as possible, I'm going to do, maybe I promised it before, The story of the Texas Department of Corrections, as of this date, they've had their 17th homicide this year. I got a letter this week from a fellow who used to live in California, who is now in Houston, and he says this is unbelievable. He had been in California county jails at one time in Monterey County and used to keep up with my broadcast, and he asked me, please, to do something on the Texas Department of Corrections, and I'm getting the articles every week from somebody who lives in Houston, Texas, and I'll keep you up on it, because Raymond Pecunier was head of the prison system here where all the black radicals were rounded up, Geronimo Pratt and George Jackson, who was murdered in the prison, and the black and the Mexican, the Chicano radicals were put into the prison and then killed by the white Aryan Brotherhood, and Pecunier was here when the races were turned against each other, and we had all these murders and arrests and in the prison system, and Pecunier went on to New Mexico after he left California, and he had a finger in the New Mexico prison when the worst criminals got the keys and the list of the informers in another part of jail and did those brutal murders, and now he's in Texas. So what happened in California is moving east, and maybe all the prisons will be that way someday. There was a starting point, and as the book California, the First Para-Fascist State explains, things start here that will go on and branch out, and so that other prisons will be doing and duplicating the behavior of Mr. Pecunier, and he does what he does best, which is setting up, at least in California, these murders and allowing them to happen. And now it's happening in Texas. And I'm sure that there's some top drug informers or people that pass through the Texas jails, and they can get rid of those people. It's pertinent to tonight's broadcast because of so many informers who were testifying and talking about Raymond Donovan, or had links to Raymond Donovan, or to his co-partner, contractor, this Mr. William Maselli, who were wiped out, links to the Genovese family, people killed in order to keep the very top, the Chevron Construction Company and Raymond Donovan in power. The witnesses are killed. And the way you get these people, they begin to talk once they're in prison. And then, like in California or Texas, Mr. Pecunier can make sure that the talkers who even have anything to say will not survive. I don't have a breakdown on all 17 that died there, but I have it here, but I'll study it and share it with you. And finally, Brown University, before we get to Donovan, Brown University had a vote there among the 700 undergraduates on choosing their poison when the nuclear war, that they want cyanide handy, and they were to vote on that, dispensing poison pills so that those people could choose the way they want to die. These are people sophisticated. Most of them went to prep schools, learned their Latin and geometry and all the languages and skills to get into a college like Brown, one of the top Ivy League schools, with many people from the CIA there and teaching there and associated with Brown. And at this point, they're going to have to vote, or decided to vote, on which way they want to die. So Jonestown leaves the jungles and the black, the uneducated, the poor, the drug addicts, and they test these things out on them, and then the Jonestown will come to America someday, because when you let these things happen and be covered up, such as Jonestown, the next choice is at Brown University in deciding the way they want to die. Now, for the remaining 45 minutes, I'm going to talk on part one on the Raymond Donovan indictment, the meaning of it. It has far-reaching implications. It could bring Reagan out of office. I said that with Nixon at the time of Watergate, even though he was elected in November. Things started coming down. There is a story behind the Donovan story. There's several working hypotheses I have, and there's a lot of questions I've asked myself, and I'll share them with you. This is as important as Watergate, because Watergate never concluded, and everyone got off. The people involved covered up. A few went to jail. A few lost their law licenses. Dorothy Hunt and about 30 primary witnesses were murdered. But the main thrust of Watergate and the government behind the government and the planned capability of coups to finalize what happened in Dallas, going all the way from Dallas up to the 70s, there were never the proper investigations or prosecutions. And I wrote about that in August of 73, the Senate Select Committee is part of the cover-up and why I believed it. Now, I'm going to give you some examples of why the Raymond Donovan story is equal to opening up, say, the John Kennedy assassination, because I think it goes back to there. Certainly, there's a lot of common threads, and as important as Watergate. This is a case that has been cooking and boiling for 4 years. Ronald Reagan says this is foul play. It came at the time of elections. There were many articles I'll share with you in 1982, even from Orrin Hatch and Edwin Meese and various people saying, get Donovan out. It's stinking to high heaven. But one of the big questions is, why did Reagan keep him in? What is the hold that Donovan has? I don't actually know the answer, but I'll give you a guess based upon various things that I put together. But the Donovan story is important, and I'm going to run down, as I say, why I think it's so important, the various points, 9 or 10, and then delve into them and the personalities later. Number one, it's the first cabinet member to ever be indicted while in office. Nobody had so much information on him before he was even nominated, or certainly after the confirmation hearings. There were confirmation hearings and investigations. Well, in 1980, at the end of 1980, in December, when Reagan was already elected and was ready to set up his transition team and the cabinet. But for 4 years, the past 4 years, Donovan has been investigated by a grand jury. Before he worked for Reagan, he was vice president of the Chiavone, Chiavone, construction company. And the statute of limitations of the four-year investigation ran out October the 1st, or would have run out October the 1st, 1984, and they would have lost the charges. So when Reagan, in his big mouth, says, you know, it's foul play, it's near elections, this is for electioneering, all you have to do, and I'll give you the sources, is read your newspapers and realize that the grand jury has been going for 4 years on this question. And it led right to Raymond Donovan and his company, and the company was being investigated. The FBI held up that evidence, and it was just within hours of the statute running off that it got under the door, just as close as that piece of scotch tape catching the guys at the Watergate Hotel. Then there was a confirmation hearing in 1980-81, the first week in January, second week. And Donovan's name came up again, and the information was withheld by the FBI at the confirmation hearing. He has some power, and we'll go into those details. Then the Senate investigated Raymond Donovan in 1982, April and May, in that time period, and all the evidence they needed to push him out. And as I say, Orrin Hatch, the conservative, wanted him out. And then the investigation was turned on to Leon Silverman, who became our... He inherited the Leon Jaworski position. Jaworski was spying on the Warren Commission to see if Ruby would talk, or when Oswald was alive, he would talk. And then he covered up the Korea Gate and the Watergate, and he had plum investigations. He knew how to put that broom and put the dirt under the rug. So Leon Silverman was brought in, and he, again, as a special counsel, cleared Donovan. So all of these investigations were brewing based on a lot of information going on since 1978. Then finally, October the 1st, 1984, the indictment came down the day that the statute of limitations ran out. Now, Reagan, as I say, is the first cabinet member to be indicted in office, and I bring up that chronology because there was every reason that he should have stepped aside after the confirmation hearings, after the Senate investigation, after Mr. Silverman, and before the indictment. He was testifying in New York a few weeks ago. Before the indictment, he should have resigned from the cabinet office. Once he was cleared by Leon Silverman, and it was cleared with a question mark, he should have gotten out then. So there's something that Reagan has to hold him and hold tight, and he's doing it. The second point is the relationship of Reagan to organized crime. I've talked to this many, many times. The role of Richard Nixon with the Vatican and Michael Sindona and the Mafia, and also Ronald Reagan with Licio Gelli and the P2, and we'll go into details. The links, the overlaying areas of crime, syndicate, Vatican, and Mafia connections. Paul Laxalt is running the GOP campaign. He's the closest friend to Ronald Reagan, advisor. the governor from Nevada, he's a senator now, close friend of Mo Dalitz, brags about it. Men at La Costa and men from the crime syndicate in Nevada, in California, and all over the country. New Jersey, Paul Exalt and Frank Sinatra and Alfred Bloomingdale with his Bernie Kornfeld, Vesco connections. Reagan is wall-to-wall mafia behind him. And so they have some hold on him. The third point is that that week in June 1982 that I stressed so many times, that important week of 82, had a series of murders that I'll run down with you and arrests. And it was the week that Edwin Wilson was arrested, that Pope John Paul II and Raymond Donovan were in Geneva. Wilson was picked up in Zurich. Donovan's witness, Fred Farino, was shot and found 6 days later shot in the head. Edwin Meese's son died in July. I'll do the chronology of the murders because I think there's a relationship between all of these, and I've mentioned them at different times. But again, this June 82, Roberta Calvi, Roberta Calvi, hung in London, and then his secretary a few days later goes flying out the window of the Banco Ambrosiano in Milan. All the fury of Paul Marcinkus and the crime syndicate and the Vatican. This John Paul II was a protege of Mr. Montini, the secretary of the Vatican, before he was Pope Paul VI. And that's where the Milan Mafia blended with Michael Sindona and came over to America. And the GOP with Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan were the epitome of these connections. Then there are the connections of this particular event, Raymond Donovan's contacts with the Genovese family, going back to Dallas, to John Kennedy, Jack Ruby's connections with Tony Genovese, the son of the big mafia boss, Vito Genovese, and Carlos Marcello from New Orleans with Jack Ruby, Jack Ruby working for Richard Nixon, Nixon working with E. Howard Hunt in the 50s, advising him on John Kennedy. Before Kennedy won the election against Nixon, then E. Howard Hunt's relationship, his attorney during the Watergate stories, or one of them was Mr. Bittman, who was the bag man for Mr. Kalmbach and paying money, William Bittman, taking money back and forth with Tony Laskowitz at drops to keep everybody silent. And Dorothy Hunt was found with a hunk of money when her plane crash went down in Chicago. William Bittman has been taken on as the attorney for Raymond Donovan, formerly one of the Watergate money droppers, bagmans to hide the crimes of Watergate, which included Dorothy Hunt. And there were lots of people murdered at the time of Watergate. But Bittman comes on with Donovan. He was working with Tony Laskowitz and Herbert Kalmbach at Watergate. And the key to all of this is, I think, the relationship of Raymond Donovan in New Orleans before he went up to New Jersey to the Chavion Company. When he was in New Orleans at Notre Dame and studied to be a priest, Mr. Cody, who became Cardinal Cody and moved to Chicago, was the head of the church in New Orleans when Marcello and these people and Clay Shaw were active, connecting to Jack Ruby and Ruby to Nixon, Nixon to Hunt and Bittman. It may sound confusing now, but this goes back to the Kennedy assassination, to the Watergate, and now up to the present time with Donovan with his massive indictment. It has a lot to do with why the president is protecting it as much as it has to do whether his company made $8 million off a contract which was federally funded and set up as a dummy front for false purposes. Another point besides the Kennedy is that this story of Donovan illustrates how congressional hearings, Senate hearings, confirmation hearings of appointments like Edwin Meese and Raymond Donovan or any of those scoundrels are covered up. The processes are deceptive. A president, if he controls the FBI, and the FBI is totally washed out, William Webster should be absolutely forced out of office for withholding evidence from the presidential transition team and from the confirmation hearings of tapes that he had of Mr. Donovan's links to Mr. Maselli of the Genovese family, Cosa Nostra, mobster, who arranges to kill and kills a competitor and then gets a contract for Donovan and is given a check from Donovan. The Senate hearings at the Labor Committee on the confirmation are as bad and fraudulent as the appointments, say, during the Weimar Republic or when Adolf Hitler was in power. No longer can the Senate hearings be trusted unless you remove Mr. William Webster as director of the FBI. Now, J. Edgar Hoover was killed in May 72. I think he was killed by the Cubans and the Watergators. There's a lot of evidence suggesting his early demise so the FBI could be taken over. William Sullivan got his files, and in came L. Patrick Gray, a long supporter of Nixon's, and he never did get appointed as FBI director because the Watergate scandals brought him down. There is no reason, with all the Donovan evidence, that William Webster should be FBI director for one more day. Not at all. So that this shows how the Senate hearings, the confirmation hearings, are rotten. This case of Donovan clearly illustrates, if you read these articles and put them together, how the FBI is a party to the crime. We know J. Edgar Hoover had close ties to the mafia, particularly at the Del Mar racetracks, but in Washington, he never found anybody of organized crime to prosecute, and he passed his eye away from them. He was mad at Robert Kennedy, who wanted to break the back of organized crime, and that again touched Carlos Marcello and Mr. Sam Giancana and Traffic Candy and Rosselli, the others who were mad at the Kennedys for trying to stop what was a groundswell movement since 1957 to reorganize the mafia in the United States and divide up the turf. Now, the FBI has all the reason, had all the reasons and information to give the transition team when Edwin Meese asked for it. They, even if he asked with a wink, it was their obligation to let them know what they knew about Donovan and William Maselli and the killing of a competitor for a bid, this Mr. Fresconi. They held back for the confirmation hearings. They held back for the Senate hearings. They held back and didn't give, or if they gave it to Leon Silverman, he didn't use it. So the special prosecutor is as tainted in this case as anything we've had in American history. And they were holding back till the statute of limitations in New York, 4 years with a grand jury. It was just through the most immense pressure that they were able to get what they wanted to conclude the indictment on the day that it was to run out. The FBI dragged their feet, and you have to again say, if the Justice Department is doing this, if the FBI, a new president is coming in, what were they protecting? I'm asking the question, I don't know. But they certainly had something to protect. Now, another point about the Donovan story is that the federal government made an arrangement when you get money for certain contracts that blacks and minorities like Puerto Ricans and Spanish do a certain amount of the work. So you'll see in the Raymond Donovan story how he took the Chavion Company and set up a dummy front, that Joe Pell, and put one black senator, a Democrat from New York State, and received federal money over the table for contracts that had one black senator, and of course then the blacks cannot get jobs building subways or construction or bridges. It was a dummy front set up with him, and now he's been accused of stealing $8 million from the contract, and part of it was to go to minority salaries. Now, Donovan not only just laced out the minorities, but this summer he offered the blacks with a 30% unemployment and the minorities a $2.50 an hour wage or nothing. He pushed that lower wage, which is what J. Peter Grace is doing for Reagan, almost like slave labor, and has no regard for blacks or raising the standard of living. And I've read the statistics a long time ago on the building construction in New York City that I don't think maybe it was 10 or 15 blacks built had a hand in any skyscraper, electrical work, steel, the digging or anything. All the construction is done by the William Maselli contractors of the Chavion and very few minorities. So he deceptively set up a dummy front, and this shows you how the blacks and Latins are kept out of the economic goodies of the federal taxpayer, and the contract is given on the condition. This was like a $186 million contract for a subway under the East River, but it, according to news accounts, is a dummy front. Another thing that this subject illustrates is how the congressional staff members, the Senate members, who were assigned in 1982 to investigate the Chavion Company, were intimidated with death threats. And after people testified, they were found dead. There were spies on the committee. There were Three spies sent by Donovan's partner, and he holds a good hunk of the Chavion in a blind trust. We'll take a one-minute break and then get back to the Senate staff and how it was infiltrated and the implications of that.